Rancho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land podcast. So I always say we have a great show, but we do have a great show today for a couple of reasons. A, we have Napoli Outsider. If you've missed a talk on Napoli on the pod, we made up for it today, about an hour deep dive on Napoli with Napoli Outsider. Also, I wanted to celebrate the life of Marvin Hagler, one of my favorite boxers ever. So we have a quick segment with Phil Brown in the middle of the podcast. If you're not into boxing, you can skip it, but I think you will enjoy it. It's short and sweet, and we pay tribute to a truly unique athlete. And because it's Friday, of course, we have 1,000 names on deck with game picks. But before we get to all that, and this is another reason why I'm excited about the show, we are joined by our dear friend, the producer, co-host of this show, Alex Goldberg, also the host, creator of the best Chelsea podcast, The Byline. If you're not a subscriber, definitely check that out. So Alex, I have to tell you this, after Chelsea's game against Atletico Madrid, totally unsolicited, Napoli Outsider sent me a message and he said, I think right now Chelsea are the third best team, a club team in the world, in Europe. He goes, after Man City and Bayern, I think Chelsea are the best team. So that got me thinking, and I was impressed. And I did watch Chelsea Atletico. I've watched a little bit. So I have to ask you two questions, Alex. A, give us a sense of what you think is different about Chelsea under Tuchel. And then the other thing, and this is right where my mind went with Outsider sending this message. Let's say Tuchel, instead of replacing Lampard, replaces Pirlo at Juve. Do you think there would have been a similar impact?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because obviously it's about Tuchel, really, at the end of the day. So, yeah, I mean, Chelsea under Tuchel has been wildly different than under Lampard, but honestly, under Sarri as well. So I was just talking about this the other day on my own podcast, that it already seems like Tuchel has taken the positives from Sarri and Frank and Conte and really just kept it at that. And obviously, we're still not in a honeymoon phase, because that would definitely be demeaning Tuchel's job so far. It's been a decent amount of time now, so I think a honeymoon phase has to be at least under 10 games. But still, we haven't experienced a loss, so obviously there can be the negative side to the coin. But it really seems like Tuchel had the ambition to come into such a difficult situation, or at least what would be for many managers, coming in the middle of the season, having a big squad of players that get paid a lot of money too. So maybe Chelsea fans and maybe Chelsea were ready to get rid of some players, but easier said than done. And it's hard to have a big squad when fringe players are senior players who have high contracts. And I know Lampard definitely struggled with that a little bit towards the end. But what Tuchel has done is, first and foremost, he's made it about the football, obviously being cohesive and having a team out there that understands what they're doing, having somewhat of a setup structure. I mean, the clean sheet streak is getting ridiculous as well. So he definitely has implemented his short-term style of football. Really important to note, because when I talk about Juve in a second, that is still going to be the same theme. He has looked at Chelsea's personnel, and he has figured out the short-term approach, something that he's still comfortable with, hence the back three, which he definitely has used a lot. But he has looked at the personnel and he has just pretty much asked himself, okay, what setup, what style fits this current personnel? So I can bunker down, I can hone in on a group right now, because we have no time to experiment. We have things to achieve. We're in the Premier League, we're in the Champions League, we're in the FA Cup. We got to get going for it right now. So that was really smart by Tuchel. Whereas Frank really was still mixing and matching, and he was still changing a lot, and it felt like there wasn't a lot of cohesion to what he was doing. I mean, he either was changing it all the time, like a lot last season, or he wasn't changing it at all, like a lot this season. So it felt almost overthought by Frank. Whereas Tuchel, he is rotating a lot, which he's always been quite good at, but he really has kept somewhat of a cohesive setup. And like I said, he's made it about a short-term approach. And before I get to the Juve part, I just want to say, Tuchel gave this brilliant answer, David, on him getting a short contract. Originally, he admitted, it's like, what, 18 months? He was a little bothered by that. He was on the fence about that. And then he had an epiphany not too much long after, really, I think the same night he was debating it all. He said to himself, well, wait a minute. If I don't do well, I'm going to be gone before the end of the contract anyway. It's Chelsea. So what does it really matter how long my contract is? Either way, I have to start off doing really well. So I think that also kind of contributed to him just immediately coming in, obviously in a kind manner, from like a personable standpoint. He was really not an authoritative figure like, hey, everybody, this is how it's going to go down. He is personable with players, which matters. But he came in and knew, wow, I need to bunker down. So now, to change it to Juve, because to answer your question on what's been different about Chelsea, it's just been cohesive. He's made the team feel like a family really quickly. So to change it to Juve, I do think he could do a lot of that with Juve. Because once again, you look at Juve, and now I'm just going off of like the Serie A standard. So Juve compared to the rest of the league, they have arguably the most talent, or up there with the most talent. They always do. So I think Tuchel could look at Juve and maybe, unlike Pirlo, he could figure out, all right, this is my team. This is my setup. I'm going to play other players, but this is kind of the guys I'm going out with, at least to start. And this is the setup, and whoever can fit in for my current starters, great, but I'm not going to just change it all over the place. And I'll really take advantage of the talent here at my disposal. But the thing is, I'm not sure he would have had the same impact, David, to this extent at least, because I think Tuchel feels a little at home almost at Chelsea right now. And it's not just because he has three Germans there, but even more than that, he has Thiago Silva there. And I know Thiago Silva's been injured for a good amount, but still, that's somebody that he had at Paris Saint-Germain. It's somebody that he really gets on with. And David, I'm not sure if you saw enough of the game the other night, but Thiago Silva up in the stands, I mean, so invested. It was crazy. I mean, it was as if he had been at the club for 10 plus years. It felt like it was Terry over there in the stands. Every play, he was into it. He was almost coaching from the stands. So I think that's really been nice for Tuchel. So I think the personnel specifically has been set up even better than it could be set up at Juve. I'm not saying that there wouldn't be characters at Juve he might know previously or might had plans for previously, but it's hard to actually get a better scenario for Thomas Tuchel specifically than what Chelsea has. And at the same time, just the last point here on the difference between the clubs, I think there is a difference of taking over a team that has won so many Scudettos in a row, and it's almost like the desperation feels more when the Scudetto is slipping away, because it's like, oh my God, are we actually not going to win it again? Whereas Chelsea, Frank didn't leave them in the best position on the table, and no matter what, it was going to be an uphill battle. So I feel like taking over Chelsea, there was a bit more of, well, we have nothing to lose, which isn't true, obviously. There's still plenty to lose. But comparatively to Juve, I do think the context is a bit different, where Chelsea's obviously job for Tuchel was, hey, get us up this table as far as you can. Whereas at Juve, it would be, hey, we need another Scudetto. We need to win this. We're sacking Pirlo and we're hiring you because we refuse to let that Scudetto go. So I do think that change of context could just be a little bit different in terms of how it could have played out for Tuchel at Juve. But like I said, I still think Tuchel could have had overall a pretty positive effect on Juve, because David, the last point, and it's the most simple point, he's a pretty damn good coach. Like, he's a pretty damn good coach. Really? The one red flag on him is just the Conte red flag. It's just the red flag of, okay, once he does experience some turmoil, some adversity, once he's been at a club long enough, that's when maybe he starts kind of bucking horns with the club he works for. But everything else is really quite positive on Tuchel. He's one of the best tacticians in the world, and he's quite personable with players. So, yeah, I do think overall he probably would have improved Juve. But I think then for Juve, it's just about how much would he have improved them to know if it was worth it sacking Pirlo, who you just appointed. And obviously Pirlo, you would hope, is kind of a long-term guy. So, yeah, he would have improved Juve, but I don't think as much as he's improved Chelsea. So Now, David, to keep the European theme going, and I'm buzzing off Chelsea's draw of getting Porto, no offense.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're going to learn about, maybe we already have, but I don't think we have. Obviously, we're going to learn about the Europa League draw and everything like that. But the latest game, of course, was AC Milan falling to Manchester United. So what did you make of that game and that tie in general?
First of all, I think you did a great job with that Lampard answer. I mean, the Tuchel answer. It's a Freudian slip right there. I think you nailed it because I don't think it would have been quite the same at Juve. I just think they are in different situations. I think, to be fair to Pirlo, a lot of things have really not gone his way this season. COVID, injuries. So I totally agree with your perspective there. And by the way, I really do think Pirlo's coming back to coach Juve next season. But to Milan, and look, I thought it was a very interesting game yesterday. My first takeaway is I really want Pogba back in Serie A desperately. I think being in an Italian stadium inspired him. Even Man United with those jerseys that look like Juve's jersey in this FIFA this year, I don't know. It just really made me miss Pogba in Serie A. And look, if he goes to Serie A, it's almost certainly just Juve, but I'd really love to see him there. But my takeaway from this Milan's games against Man United, and I kind of see them as both, is that I do think it's a little bit overblown, this whole storyline of Milan being in a total collapse right now. Like, are they struggling? No doubt about it. Are they as good as they were last year? No. And they were probably the best team in Serie A. If you look at 2020 as a calendar year, they were the most consistent. Have they been as good in 2021? No. But I don't think this free fall total collapse is fair. They've had a ton of injuries. They were decimated. I mean, they have Castillejo as a false nine playing against Man United. They've had really a lot of injuries to key players. So my takeaway is I'm actually pretty optimistic about Milan. Some players that, you know, I think they can help out. Like even guys like Mate, yeah, he messed up on the goal, but he's pretty valuable playing next to Kessie. So I think the big mistake for Milan was the Mandzukic signing. That really hurt. And look, you know, we kind of complimented that signing on this pod, so I'm not going to be a hypocrite, but Guardalina and I, we mentioned that Mandzukic is similar to Ibrahimovic in body type and even attitude. So it makes sense, but he just isn't in game shape and they're paying him a lot to sit on the bench. But, you know, look at Tomori, an absolute home run of a January signing. So I don't know. My takeaway is, to me, and I've said it before, I think we look at Milan. Had Milan been building their way up to being in the top three positions in Serie A this season, as opposed to rushing to a great start, being at the top, and, you know, teams catching up to them, I really think we'd be looking at them differently. I think the cavalry's coming for Milan. We saw Ibrahimovic come in the second half. Bennacer is coming back. Hernandez, you know, hopefully will get healthier. So I don't know. That's really my takeaway. Is that, you know, from the Milan's perspective, this time last year, they didn't have 11 players that you could count on. Now, you know, they have a good starting line, a very good starting lineup, and they have increased depth. My last takeaway, and I'm going to tie it back to Pogba, is just something that I think a lot about, and that I think it's a little bit easy to kind of fall in love with your own players. And let me give you this example. I think Kessie and Bennacer, when he's healthy, I think those guys are really excellent players. They both improved a ton this season. Those guys make a difference for Milan. I think both of them could play for Juve, especially right now in their midfield. But there is a big but. You saw what Pogba did in the second half. And I know Man United fans say, oh, you know, Pogba, one big game that everyone praises him, but he's done it a lot on the big stages. And I just think, you know, players like Kessie and Bennacer are very, very good. Maybe you can make a case Kessie becomes an elite player. It's possible. Maybe Bennacer too. But I do think there is a level, and I think there's a reason guys like Pogba are paid as much as they are, and it's not just marketing. I just think there is kind of that level. And to me, this is why it's so easy to fall in love with your own players. And this is why when I look at the transfer market, I don't really ask myself, has this team improved over what they had last year? Yeah, that's important. But what's much more important is, have you improved with players that could start for the teams you're trying to catch up to? I think of a lot of the things that we've discussed on the podcast, looking at it that way is maybe the thing I'm most proud of, because I think it really is an important exercise. So watching Pogba and Man United, that was another reminder that, you know, you can say, oh, my players are great and all, but then, you know, you also have to ask yourself, would my great players be able to play for a top, top team? So great to see Pogba back. And now with the games coming up this weekend, we have 1,000 names on deck. As usual, we're going to pick three games. First one, Atalanta traveling to Verona. 1,000 has Atalanta winning 3-0. Goals by Zapata, Malinowski, Pessina. The comment is Murillo is going to miss a penalty. He said Gasperini is going to avenge the first time they met Verona at the start of the season by destroying his pupil. As we discussed on the podcast, Juric is a disciple from the Gasperini school. And he says that Juric is in free fall after drawing against Pirlo, and that Atalanta has forgotten about their Champions League elimination. Interesting game. Hellas Verona, maybe not as good recently. I do agree with Thousand that I think Atalanta are going to look to kind of make a statement after being eliminated in the Champions League. But I'm going to go 1-0, and I'll give a goal to Zapata. Next up, Torino traveling to Genova to face Sampdoria. Thousand has Sampdorino 1-2, goal by Yoshida and a brace by Belotti. He says Nicola wins his derby by winning at the Marassi. Nicola, of course, has a background with Genoa. And he says Torino president is going to enjoy himself thanks to the favors of the ASL. This is, you know, a comment on games being rescheduled or not because of COVID. You'll hear Napoli outsiders' thoughts on that at the end of the podcast. And then he says that Belotti has returned even stronger from COVID. So Torino had that huge win comeback against Sassuolo. Sampdoria have been pretty good. I'm going to go draw 0-0. And last match, Milan traveling to Florence to face Fiorentina. 1,000 has Milan winning 2-0. Goals by Theo, braced by Theo. He says Donnarumma is going to save a penalty kick. He says Pioli is going to make up for the elimination in the Europa League by defeating Prandelli. And he says this is a showdown between two guys that should have become priests instead of coaches. Yeah, Pioli and Prandelli are kind of the nice, not the fiery type coaches, to say the least. I'm going to go draw. Milan, again, I'm more optimistic than most. Fiorentina does need points. So I'll go 1-1, and I'll give a goal to Vlahovic, who is on fire. And this is Napoli Outsiders Week, so we'll give a goal to his pupil and a goal to Ibrahimovic. So, guys, let's take a little break from football. We're not doing pop culture, but we are going to get back to pop culture soon. The Oscars are coming. I got some thoughts, but today we're going to pay tribute to Marvin Hagler, one of the best boxers of my lifetime, with my dear friend Phil Brown. If you're not into boxing, you can skip it, but I do think you will enjoy this segment. Okay, well, I'm beyond excited to welcome the next guest, which we should have had on ages ago, but a couple of things happened. So my dear friend Phil Brown, for those of you that know me long-term, Beyond the Pitch, which is a show he's been involved with and still runs brilliantly, today was really the first place that gave me a chance. And I've loved Phil. We became a really good friend since. So he asked me to come on his podcast, and we just talked about the Milan-Man United game. We recorded that right before. So I asked him, hey, come on to talk about Marvin Hagler, because Phil not only is the king of Man United, but I'd say I even love talking boxing with him even more because he knows the sport incredibly well. So unfortunately, with Marvin Hagler's passing, I had to have Phil on. So with that long intro, dear brother, really a pleasure to welcome you back. Bentornato to Calcio Land, as we say in Italy.
My pleasure, David. It's always an honor for me to be on, and it's great to see how well you've done with your podcast, everything else. It's always an honor. So thanks for having me on, brother.
My pleasure. Well, I wish it was under better circumstances, but we're going to celebrate how great Marvin Hagler is. So I'll just tell you real fast my connection to him. You know, in the 80s, when he was at his glory days, I was growing up in Italy, and my first sports hero was Larry Bird. So I had this Boston thing already in my mind. And then, you know, I was really into boxing at that time. And Hagler was just this amazing badass. And he comes from Brockton, which is right outside Boston. So I always knew he had that connection. And on top of that, Hagler loved Italy. I think he had started being involved with Italian movies. But long and short of it, he spent a lot of time in Milan. A lot of my friends in Italy adore him because of his ties to him. So that's kind of what I always thought of him. And of course, the great Hearns fight. But you know him way better. So give their listeners a sense as to why Hagler was so special and so revered.
You know, Dave, to put it in football terms, if you remember last year when Maradona died, the whole football world went into mourning. And if you were from that generation and you watched Maradona, it made you extremely nostalgic for that, because it was a generation at a time when, you know, football was football. And yes, there were certain things about the game that were not pleasant, but there was a certain raw authenticity about the sport back then. So if you go back to Marvin Hagler, a lot of the problems in fast boxing today didn't back then. And it's no surprise that that was the key era, really, up to the late 80s. It was when boxing was thriving the most. Marvin Hagler fought everyone and anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, he fought John McGabby. When who would fight John McGabby? He didn't need to fight John McGabby. He's already the champion. You know, it's just unbelievable. And of course, his fight, Tommy Hearns is what's remembered the most.
Yeah.
Tommy, the guy that was the world title was essentially taken from him, Alfredo Antifermo, in a draw. That he was a close fight, to be fair, not a robbery, but I thought he won the fight. It was really close in a 15 round fight. But Dave, that was his 50th fight before he got a shot at the world title. 50th fight, that's unheard of. You know, most fighters are getting a shot at the world title 15, 20 fights. So had to do it the hard way. And then, of course, when he did win it, he won it in England against Alan Minter. Disgraceful scenes that happened after, where he was on, like, every champion that wins a belt gets the opportunity to hold it above their head, celebrate it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, due to racism and other issues, he was not allowed to do that, which is a disgrace. But what a fighter.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, and I love that perspective that you gave. You know, what you said, it took him a long time to get the title shot. And then, as you said, he really took pride in defending the title against the best competition. And I think even one of the first few title defense, like, he wanted to do it here in Boston, defend it here. But I remember the Leonard fight is probably the other most famous one after Hearns. And, you know, A, I want to ask you who you think won that fight, which was really controversial. And B, what do you make of the fact that Hagler didn't go for a rematch and then never fought again after, and then just retired from Italy? It feels like he's probably the rare fighter who really left and didn't come back for money, maybe after the fact. So A, tell me, who do you think won? And were you surprised that he just packed up and left after that?
Yeah, I have watched that fight. First of all, there's two things. Sugar Ray Leonard was extremely smart in, first of all, demanding a 12-round fight, not a 15-round fight. I think that that fight goes 15 rounds, Hagler wins it comfortably. However, maybe he doesn't, for the reason that he didn't win in the first place, in the sense that Sugar Ray Leonard was always the golden boy. You know, he was the Olympic golden boy. You know, he was the pretty boy. He was the guy that... well, America certainly loves, and Hagler was the brooding, bald, you know, dark type of character, and wasn't given the same love. And he felt that, you know, this was about splitting the belts up. This was about giving everything to Sugar Ray Leonard. And he also referred back to his Vito Antifermo fight, where he goes, look, I fought Antifermo. I didn't get the win because I didn't convincingly take the belt off the champion. He shouldn't have got the win the same way. And I sort of agree with Hagler in that sense. So he was so sickened by that decision and the favoritism that blighted his career, the boxing show towards Sugar Ray Leonard, was never given it easy, did walk away and retire. Depends on who you believe. He says he wanted the rematch. Sugar Ray Leonard says he was offered the rematch, but was never given formally. But there was no one left for Hagler to fight after Sugar Ray Leonard. At that point, I don't disagree with him walking away. His legacy was intact, and just a guy from a different era that would have fought the devil.
Absolutely. So I love, by the way, that Maradona comparison. Really good. So, Phil, it's wonderful talking to you. Just tell our listeners, I was just on a Beyond the Pitch. Tell our listeners what's going on there. Always a great show, guys. You know, it's not just because Phil's my friend, but there's a lot of great stuff going on there. So tell our
listeners about it. Well, you can go find our podcast at Beyond the Pitch. We're very fortunate to have good relationships with people where we get lots of really good guests on, Premier League footballers. So if you get an opportunity to check it out, it's worth the download, folks. We've been doing it a long time, so we always appreciate the support. So just go to at Beyond the Pitch, you'll find it. And, you know, it's something that I love to do, Dave. You know, I'm very, very fortunate to enjoy the access that I do. And it's something that is just a wonderful creative outlet. And I'm proud that certain people have launched their careers starting there, and it's great, always great to see fellow brethren going on and doing so well. So thank you so much, as always, for the intro, Dave, and thanks for coming on the show.
Okay, so always a pleasure to chat with my friend Phil Brown. I really mean it. Check out Beyond the Pitch. It's a labor of love for Phil, and he does a great job there. So now let's get to our patrons. If you enjoy Cultureland, you know, we have this episode on Friday available to all. Consider becoming a patron. Hey, I want to thank the many people that joined us this month. The Napoli Outsider chats, I really think, are worth the subscription alone. So today, everyone hears him on Napoli. We went deep on Napoli. You can hear us go for about 80 minutes on Serie A once a month, just for patrons, and I have to tell you, it really, really is awesome content. And I am going to tease, I am about to make a very cool signing. It's not a huge name to join our patron, but if you have been on Twitter for a very long time and love Calcio, there is someone who's back, who's really, really good, and we are working on a cool project on Patreon. So stay tuned for that. And now let's get to our current patrons with their questions. So, Alex, I'm going to have you lead us off with the first few. Okay. I am one of my favorite dates of the month is when I get to chat calcio with Napoli Outsider. If you're just a regular subscriber on iTunes, Spotify, you hear him talk Napoli on the show once a month. If you are a patron, you hear that, but you also hear us go deep on Serie A, on all the topics, which is a lot of fun. So if you enjoyed these interviews, consider becoming a patron. So I know today, just programming note, we are recording this Tuesday morning. If you are a patron, you're hearing this pretty much same day. If you're a non-patron, you'll hear this on Friday, but we kept it not really time sensitive. So without further ado, Napoli Outsider, it's always a real pleasure to chat calcio with you. Bentornato.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. It's always a blast to be with you.
Okay, my friend. So I had a few people ask me if you had changed your mind on Gattuso. You've been pretty harsh on him recently. And look, the match against on Sunday against Milan was an important win. I think, you know, last time you were on, we were talking a lot about how Gattuso is perceived in the media in Italy. A lot of his former teammates, a lot of people that like him, he probably has a good perception with the media. So with how he's perceived and all, if you had to give him a grade, though, for actual results and what he's done for the team this season, what would that grade be and why?
This season probably would be a C for me. And I know that's on the low end, but that's the thing. You know, I'm not impressed at all with what he's been doing. And yes, you did mention the media. Now, the national media is really right on his side. They keep praising him. And seriously, the praise I've seen lavished on him and Pirlo this year has been completely ridiculous. Like people saying literally they invented soccer. I mean, this week, after Juventus crashed out of the Champions League, there was an article on a paper owned by the Juventus owner, obviously, saying that Pirlo invented a new type of soccer. And Gattuso is getting much of the same type of praise. Now, it's totally ridiculous for so many reasons. But it starts with the fact that obviously those two were some of the centerpieces of the 2006 World Cup win, and a lot of their former teammates are in the media now, and they're friends with everybody, and so on and so on. But speaking specifically of Gattuso, I mean, look, I've been used since forever at having Napoli managers getting criticized, even beyond their actual faults. Benitez was almost insulted daily on TV. Sarri was criticized. Now, Ancelotti also, even though in the beginning they were kind of protecting him, but in the end they were almost laughing at him as well. And Mazzarri, you know, he was, well, he is a whiner, but he was called out as a whiner, which doesn't always happen, you know. A lot of guys whine, but they don't get called out. With Gattuso, it seems like, look, it seems like other, without Gattuso, Napoli would be in Serie B or something by the national media. Local media are very different, and I think local media might have been too harsh on him, if anything. But I think it's kind of trying to counterbalance things. For me, he has done a C-level type of work, because I see a lot of issues with his work. I think he has created a lot of issues for himself, and that's why he could have done a lot better. Now, obviously, he could finish Serie A in the top four spots. That was the goal, and that's very attainable. And I would think that would bring him up to a B, though. Not more than that anyway. Because by the way the Serie A season has unfolded, I think, you know, maybe not the Scudetto, but probably second place, you know, a much bigger challenge than the one he's set up could have been put up. And you can just look at what happened throughout the season to highlight his own fault. Now, for example, a lot of people are saying, yeah, but he's had a lot of injuries. Now, first of all, that is not exactly true. The injuries came all at the same time. Yes, that is true. But in total, there weren't that many injuries as opposed to most of the other teams. I think out of the top seven, only Inter had fewer total days, match days of injuries lost, okay, injury time. Now, obviously, the fact that he lost all his three center forwards at the same time, or, for example, he lost both Manolas and Koulibaly together. Now, that's bad luck. But it's not just luck. To point this out, I will mention, for example, what happened to Rahmani. Rahmani now is one of the only three guys out for Napoli, and those three guys will soon become only two. And Rahmani he played 0 minutes for most of the season. Then all of a sudden, he played 7 games in a row every 3 days, and then he pulled a muscle. Should we be surprised that he pulled a muscle after this pattern of this usage pattern? I don't think we should be. Or, for example, Mertens. Mertens had just come back, and he threw him onto the pitch when Napoli was beating Spezia in Coppa Italia on a 4-0 scoreline. And he re-aggravated that injury, and he was out for a lot more time after that. That's just simply his own fault. Or, for example, Lozano. Lozano got hurt against Juventus. You know, he had been playing so many minutes at that point. He got hurt like in the 92nd minute against Juventus, and he said he was done. And Gattuso told him to just get back on the pitch while he was hurt. And so he went on defense. He kicked the ball away, you know, at some point. And that was that. He got a lot worse, and then he was out for a few weeks. And he might come back against Roma in a part-time role, and after the break, even better. But the point is that you cannot claim bad luck if these guys stay out for a month when you've been using them the wrong way. Or, for example, just another very recent example, Napoli played against Sassuolo. They were winning, obviously, in the 94th minute. And then Sassuolo tied it when Manolas committed a really stupid foul. Now, you might say, yeah, an experienced player shouldn't have done that. Yeah, but what is being missing in this is what happened 5 minutes before. Now, Manolas came on about 5 or 7 minutes before the 90th minute. And he actually came in for Maximovic, who was playing on the center left. But Manolas usually plays on the center right. So not only he came on for a central defender, they had to reshuffle the defense, put them out of position with just like a few minutes to go. He was cold, and he was caught flat-footed. But not only that, Manolas had been out with an injury, and he was playing with an injury. In fact, after that foul, he re-aggravated himself. He was not fine when he came on for that game, and there was no reason to bring him on. But Gattuso just did. And so So not only he lost 2 points with that move, he lost Manolas again, and Manolas was not even on the bench in the last game. I don't know if he's going to be on the bench against Roma. So this is all of his own doing. Or yet another example, which did not cost points, well, I would say fortunately, but which also shows how he was just in confusion. Against Atalanta, now obviously Napoli lost 4-2 in that game, but they allowed one goal from a corner kick. And right before the corner kick, he brought on Koulibaly. And obviously, Koulibaly being a central defender, by the way, Napoli marks on corner kicks, he is pretty much the centerpiece of that defense. So they had to reposition themselves, but they did not have time to reorganize themselves. Usually, coaches do not make substitutions before a defensive corner kick because of this exact issue. And guess who was out of position? Of course, it was Koulibaly. He had just come on. It's not even his fault because you need to communicate, and he didn't have time to do that. So this is all of his own doing, and he's been in confusion. Now, the positive things, the first 10 match days of the season, he did extremely well. And now in the last 4 match days, he had 10 points out of 12, and without that Sassuolo blunder, it would have been 12 out of 12. So when he says that he requires or needs the full week, the typical week of training to succeed, to show his tactics, that is true. But that is not an excuse. It cannot be an alibi. In fact, if anything, it makes it worse. First of all, it shows that you cannot coach a European level team. Because, of course, if you are playing in Europe, yeah, you will never have the full week. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing, it just showed how much in confusion he went. Like, as soon as he had the first challenges or difficulties after the first 10 match days, he changed the way they played from a 4-2-3-1. He gave in to the pressure of the media. He went to a 4-3-3, made certain blunders. He was totally in confusion. He actually feuded with the media to the point that that the president had to call off all media inquiries to Napoli. They have a no press policy right now. They do not answer questions from the press. And I think, you know, as much as usually I would say that's just a bad policy, in the case of Gattuso, it had become necessary because he was more concentrating on picking up fights with certain local media guys than actually coaching. So, you know, a guy like this, who cannot be level-headed, he cannot be cool-headed, and he didn't want to stick to his own convictions, that just shows a lot of limitations. And it feels like Napoli lost a lot of points. Now, obviously, they are making them up. They might make them up over the next 12 match days. There's still a lot of soccer to be played. It's almost a third of a season to be played for Napoli, 12 match days out of 38. But that doesn't change the fact that Napoli are probably 5 or 6 or maybe even more points behind as opposed to what they should be. They probably still would not be challenging for the Scudetto race, but they would be in a much better position for a Champions League spot. And not only that, they probably would be much better off in the Europa League as well, which, you know, they just crashed out. And you also brought this terrible mindset where, and I have to say, this is very common to most Italian coaches because it's common to Conte, it's common to Sarri, and others, that getting out of the European Cup is actually a good thing because they can concentrate on the league. And I think that's just mediocrity at its worst. We play the whole season to qualify for European spots, and then all we care about is the money, really, because as soon as we qualify, we just wait to crash out so that we can concentrate on the league. It's just sick for me, and I think that's wrong. So Gattuso has that mentality again, and I don't think he's done a very good job. Right now he's doing better. He's showing that he can be a good coach, but he still has certain limitations that are too big for a club of a European level. So, for example, they said that next year he might go to Fiorentina. I would not be surprised if he did very well.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I totally agree.
Because he's
I would actually
the
like
full
to
week,
see it.
No pressure. Right. But that's not a good thing for him. You know, if you want to coach at the highest level, you've got to be able to coach every 3 days. And if you do not have an alternative, to coaching the week-long system, well, then you're never going to be able to do well with a good team. That's just as things are, you know.
Yeah, I see Gattuso either at Fiorentina or down the road as Italy manager, and I think he'd do okay there. But let's talk about Napoli's ceiling. Obviously, they've made some progress. Big win against Milan. It certainly helped that Roma drop points as well. So they are, you know, they have a game in hand. They are 2 points out of a Champions League spot with a game in hand against Juve. So let me ask you, do you think ultimately Napoli finish in top four? And my follow-up is, which of the four teams between Inter, Milan, Juve, and Atalanta is more likely to drop off? And if Napoli finish in the top four, do you think that's enough for Gattuso to keep his job?
Now, no, he's not going to keep his job. I would be surprised if he did, because of all the things I've said. You know, even if he does finish in the top four, he finishes in top four, and he will still leave you a bitter taste in your mouth where you're going to think that you could have done better, both in the league and in the European Cups. And you cannot go through another year in which, you know, you basically ditch European football, especially because if he does finish in the top four, next year European football is going to be the Champions League, and you cannot just mistreat it like that. So he's shown his limitations, and I think he's got to go despite finishing in the top four. You cannot risk again. That's the very first thing. I know it started from the last question, but going back to which of the four currently in the top four positions might miss out on the Champions League, I wish you asked this to me on Friday. And the reason is that that obviously depends a lot on the fact that Milan and Atalanta might progress or not in their own European Cup. Because one of the things we've seen this year, obviously, is the incidence of the European Cups on how teams have performed. Inter just basically, and we had predicted that because it's kind of Conte's mojo,
yeah.
Inter just took off when they got out of the European Cups. They became almost unbeatable, and we knew that. And Napoli, 10 points out of 12, and they should have been 12 out of 12 once they got out of the European Cups. So, and we kind of expect that to continue, right? And if Atalanta and Milan are going to stay in there, especially Milan with a shortened squad, they're going to risk a lot. I mean, Milan have been the worst of the top seven since 2021 kicked in. And if they're going to stay in Europe, that's going to be very I mean, they have to try to do that. I think it builds for the future. And you are Milan. You cannot just kick European Cups away. And I wish Napoli didn't either. So, you know the way I think. But the fact is, if they do stay in Europe, they're going to be in trouble. You know, they do have 6 points of advantage on Napoli, but it's 6 points and a game. So it might only be three. And they're not playing well. So right now, I would say, you know, I know they're in second place, but Milan are the one that are looking not very solid. Inter and Juventus, they're probably the two best squads, and they do not have any European games. So I think they're pretty much locked to finish one and two. Atalanta, we're gonna talk about Atalanta in the other segment. But, you know, right now they're actually potentially in fifth place because obviously Napoli have a game in hand, so they're potentially ahead of Atalanta. But Atalanta are a really good team, and they're playing very well. They're actually very hot at the moment. So I think they should get in. I think Milan are the ones that are most at risk. That being said, Atalanta right now are hot. But as I said, there's a lot of football, a lot of soccer to be played, almost a third of the season. If you get cold for 3 or 4 days or 4 matches,
yeah, it looks totally different. Yeah, it's amazing how quickly things turn. Yeah, it's amazing how quickly in the blink of an eye it changes, for sure. For sure. So let's talk about a few individual players. I've had this question saved for you for a while, so I'm just going to ask it now. If you could go back in time right now to when Napoli was negotiating the extension with Mertens, which was the first real big transaction after COVID, and I was surprised that he got a big salary. If you could go back in time, would you do that extension again?
Had to be done at the time. That's what I thought, and I still think it right now. You know, there was a very short market window this year, obviously, and there weren't that many forwards on the market. In fact, Napoli had to overspend to get one. Now, imagine if they had to get two. And the second one was also basically one of the leaders, even though I do think that there needs to be a change in leadership. This was not probably, the window was probably not long enough to change the core of the team. In fact, Napoli only brought in two new players in addition to the ones they purchased in January. So it kind of had to be done. They didn't have a lot of choices. They did let Callejon go because they had Lozano and Politano on the right, so that was a good call. But finding two center forwards, given that Milik was already scheduled to leave, it was going to be impossible. So we kind of knew that Mertens was not going to be worth his money, but it's only 2 years, and it had to be done. I really didn't find – I don't think he had a lot of alternatives. The ideal situation for Napoli is that Napoli plays with a 4-2-3-1 formation with Zielinski behind Osimhen, and Mertens comes on as a super sub. I think, you know, in 30-minute stints, he can still make a difference. Obviously, if he has to play every 3 days, if he has to start every 3 days, now he's also got the bad ankle, I think he's going to be worn out, because a lot of those Napoli players who played a lot of minutes in the last 5 or 6 years, they seem to be worn out before time. You know, Callejon right now looks like an ex-player with Fiorentina.
He is.
He's only 33. Hamsik was probably done at 32. Mertens now pretty much the same thing. And it goes on for a lot of those guys. They're just worn out. But in the case of Mertens, I think they did not have any alternatives. What they would have liked, I'm sure, is for everybody to stay healthy so that Mertens could have been used accordingly as needed. But they had to press him like a lemon because Osimhen got his shoulder hurt, then he got COVID, then he had a concussion. He went through the whole thing. So he had to be used too much. But, yeah, I mean, I wish they had a better option, and I wish his contract had been running out this summer, because in that case, the call would have been an easy one. But running out last summer, I don't think they had any alternatives. They had to renew him for a couple of years, and they did what they had to do.
Interesting. So let's talk about the other striker. And look, I think when Osimhen's played, he's looked quite good. So let me ask you this. Compared to the last time we talked, and I know he's been injured and he's come back and whatnot, do you feel more or less optimistic about Osimhen being a very important long-term piece for Napoli?
I feel pretty confident, especially once Gattuso goes. And this is not a jab at Gattuso. No, it's not a jab at Gattuso, I promise. It's just the way he plays. Now, you've seen Osimhen now playing three different stints. He played in the first 8 games, and Napoli were great. Were absolutely great in that time. Even though he only scored 2 goals, Napoli were scoring at will because he was taking up the whole defense, and everybody was getting on the end of passes and was shooting from everywhere. So things were going well. Then he played in the second stint, you know, after COVID and after his shoulder. But he was playing with an armor on his shoulder. So he wasn't loose, he wasn't powerful, and he couldn't run fast. And he just looked atrocious. Now he's playing after concussion, and he seems to be finally healthy. And he has been looking brilliant in the last 2 games. But the thing is, the way Gattuso uses him, no, Gattuso uses him as if he was Catania. So back to the goal, 50 yards from goal, he has to shield the ball, protect the ball, pass it back to his teammates. That's not what he does. What he does, or what he should do, is play an Immobile type of game, or a Timo Werner type of game. Obviously, Timo Werner, the Leipzig version, not the Chelsea version. So he has to play face to the goal, and you do not have to pass it to him. You have to pass it into space and let him run onto it. Just like the goal he scored against Bologna. Now, against Bologna, obviously, was against Danilo, who is not exactly a 25-year-old sprint-apt defender. But that's the way he has to play. You play it into space for him to run onto, and he's just irresistible. But if Gattuso is not going to be able to play like that, then he's always going to have certain limitations to his game. That being said, even with Gattuso, he has looked better. So I would say I am relatively optimistic, not more, not less than I was at the beginning of the year. But I think this year is going to be kind of a mulligan for him. You got to give him a mulligan because of all the things that have happened to him. But I look at him as a Lozano-like version, in the sense that many of the same things happened to Lozano last year, and he's looked great this year. Osimhen obviously is younger than Lozano was, And I'm not sure he's as good as Lozano in general, but I think he's going to be good enough to justify his inclusion in the squad. So I am relatively optimistic in him. But again, starting next year, depending on the coach.
I hear you. So let's talk about two midfielders. I think Zielinski has been absolutely brilliant this season. When I watch Napoli, to me, he's often the best player. Insigne has been great too, but I love Zielinski. And I have to say, it's rare for me to watch Fabian Ruiz and be really that impressed. And it feels to me that maybe the market hasn't caught up maybe to the difference in how good these players are compared to one another. So do you agree with that? My assessment is very superficial, but that's kind of how I see it. How do you see Zielinski versus Fabian Ruiz? And do you think it's fair that to say that Zielinski is the superior player right now?
Well, I think that Zielinski has a team that is almost built around him right now. We've got 4-2-3-1 formation because, for example, against Milan, he played behind the striker, but he also fell back into that mezzala role every now and then, and he can do both things, and that's just, and that was just built perfectly for him. So, so I think you know, his performances are maximized. That being said, Zielinski is 26, going on 27. He has unfortunately a long history of being inconsistent. I think the last 3 months in which he has been consistent are kind of a new thing for him. But to remember that in the beginning of the season, when the whole of Napoli was playing well, he was not, in part because he had COVID and he had it with symptoms. So it took him quite a while to get going. But the point still remains that he has never had in his career. And again, he was born in 1994, so he's 27 this year. He's never had a full consistent season. Now, when he's at his best, he really looks like Kevin De Bruyne. At his best, like in his best games. He can do everything. But there's a reason for which he's not Kevin De Bruyne. And there's a reason for which, when you think about the 10 best midfielders in the world, you never mention him, despite having the skills to be in that group. And it is consistency, really, and the fact that he usually, in big games, kind of tends to disappear. He has not done that recently, so... You know, you want to see that as reason for optimism, that's okay, but you've got to take that with a grain of salt. And again, there's a reason for which nobody's ever gone to Napoli bringing 70 million to make an offer. And remember that until last year, he still had a release clause of about 55 million. And until last year, there was no COVID, and still nobody spent that for him. I don't want to underplay how good he is, because I love him. But I also have to be realistic, and there's a reason that nobody ever spent that. Now, if this is the new version of Zielinski, then, hey, it's everybody else's problem, but not Napoli's problem. But we have to face the fact that history says that about him. Regarding Fabian Ruiz, on the other hand, things are a bit different because, first of all, he's a natural mezzala, but we're not playing with mezzalas right now. So he's playing out of position, and that's the very first thing that comes with him. He's not very fast, but he has vision, he has intelligence, and he's a very vertical type of player. But we, instead of playing vertically, we do a lot of possession. Now, he plays a lot better for the Spanish national team in that mezzala role. And the other problem is that the teams that were interested in him, Barcelona and Real Madrid, their finances have been really taking a hit with COVID. So unless Manchester City, which was the third team that was mentioned, interested in him, unless Manchester City really steps up and invests in him, then he's probably going to stay back in Naples. But, you know,
I'm sure they can't wait to negotiate with De Laurentiis again after Jorginho
and City.
I'm sure they are so happy to get that going.
Very good point, actually. Now that you mention it, that's a very good point. So if Manchester City are not going to invest, and Barcelona and Real Madrid have limited room for investments, all of a sudden there's no market for him anymore, because that's kind of the issue. But to be honest, I really like the way he plays with intelligence. He has also been inconsistent, but I think it's just getting used to that, to this hybrid role where he plays with Demme. Now, when he was playing with Bakayoko, I think he was struggling a bit more. With Demme on his side, he plays a lot better. Against Milan, I think he played a very, very good game. Very one-touch, two-touch football, always vertically, always going forward, defends the ball. He's got a good body. I think he works really well in the right setting. But again, like Zielinski, he needs the right setting. Zielinski has it this year. Fabian Ruiz probably not. So I think that's where you see a bit of dissonance between the two. But I think that both of them are really, really good players. And to be honest, I think out of the two, the one that would fetch more money on the market is still Fabian Ruiz, regardless, because of the age, because of the fact that midfielders with that kind of body and that kind of technique are always, always looked for. You know, they're always searched by teams because it's kind of rare. Usually when you have that type of body, you're probably better defensively than offensively, whereas he can do a bit of everything. And, I mean, he's not Pogba, but the idea that you get in terms of body and technique and the offensive mentality is kind of the same. And those guys are always, I don't want to say overrated, but they're certainly rated very highly by teams in Europe right now.
Okay, so just a note for there's a listener who says, I always agree with the guests on everything. So far today, we've already disagreed on Mertens and the two midfielders, which I like. So let's talk about the Mercato, because you've taught us so much about Napoli transfer window, like how financially conservative they are and how they've set themselves up, you know, to be profitable and even deal with eliminations with not being in the Champions League. So let me ask you this, and this obviously is after a year of COVID. In addition, how different will Napoli's transfer window look depending on if they qualify for the Champions League or not? As you mentioned, for Italian teams, the motivation seems to be more about getting the money that comes with that than actually doing well. So how different do you think the transfer window looks for Napoli depending if they're in or out of the Champions League?
Extremely different this year. There are a lot of reports coming out of Naples saying that the ownership group is very worried about future revenues after COVID because they think it's not going to get back to what it was. So if you miss out on the Champions League, you have to set up the team for fewer revenues than you were used to. And because Napoli, even though they have a lot of reserves right now, they have well over 100 million euros on their bank account with no debt. There is no debt on Napoli. They are probably going to downsize probably a bit, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. You can consider it a reload, you know, investing on young players. But yeah, if Napoli miss out on the Champions League, they might take a step back, hoping to take two steps forward in the future. Whereas if they get into the Champions League, I think it's going to be business as usual. I think they will still be looking for takers at the right amount for Koulibaly and Fabian Ruiz.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I don't expect a lot of difference from what's going on now. If they do miss out on the Champions League, then all bets are off. Anything can happen, honestly, because I think Lozano might go. I think right now they're discussing about Insigne. Today, two different sports agencies have said that Insigne might not renew his contract and leave. So a lot of stuff might happen. Who knows, really? Because if the reports are true about De Laurentiis being afraid of reduced revenues post-COVID in the years to come, then if they miss out on the Champions League, really anything can happen.
Interesting. I got to be honest, I didn't expect this answer, but very interesting. And I think it's the COVID, right, is the big thing. Like, had there not been that, Napoli would, as you said, they're in great shape and they've saved money. So that's very interesting.
Well,
this
is something I want to point out, though. They're still in great shape. The thing is that De Laurentiis is always a guy that thinks 2 or 3 years ahead. And he thinks that the balance sheet is sacred. And while I do agree with that, he's always he never wants to get in the red for any reason. So, you know, if he does think that COVID is going to hurt future revenues, and it seems to be the case, for example, for TV revenues, they're discussing about that a lot in these few days. If that happens, you know, then it's going to be inevitable, because not because Napoli need to, but because they want to keep being wealthy. Let me put it that way. That's his priority. Again, as I said, they do have more than 100 million euros on the side, debt-free in the bank. So they could actually withstand probably 2 years without the Champions League, without downsizing. but De Laurentiis always thinks of a cycle ahead. So yeah, that's where we are. It's not something fans would want to hear, but let's hope that Napoli make the Champions League so all this becomes moot.
Yep. So let's go on the assumption they make the Champions League, and I'm going to give you a little leeway where you can maybe be a little more aggressive than De Laurentiis. If you had to make some moves to try to catch up to Juve and Inter, because look, at the beginning of the season, I think most people were like, Juve and Inter have the two best squads, Napoli probably the third best, but there was a difference even at the beginning. So what would you say Napoli needs to do to get to that level?
Well, the first thing, the very first thing, indispensable, is wingbacks, especially a left wingback. There's no question. On the right, you know, Di Lorenzo has been kind of a cyborg, and he hasn't missed a beat, fortunately. But if he had missed a beat, it would have been drama, because he's the only decent wingback on the team.
Yeah.
On the left, Napoli had three. They had Yusai, they had Mario Rui, they had Goulam. But now, obviously, Goulam, unfortunately, his body is just gone, and he has been gone for years, and he's out of action now. But the other two were just not at Napoli's level, not at anybody's level. And so the very first thing is getting wingbacks. Then if you're going to play 4-2-3-1 like they've been playing right now, they probably need one or two new midfielders, just tactically, by characteristics, not necessarily by value, or not necessarily numerically, but they need to shape up tactically with tactically appropriate players. Because when Demme is missing, for example, there's nobody that plays like him, and that creates an issue. And but that's pretty much it, really, to be honest. If they're going to play 4-3-3, probably actually the same. Wingbacks and probably one midfielder that can take over for Demme, given that Lobotka doesn't seem to be good enough at all. So those are the first two things that I would be looking for. If you want, and if there's money on the side, if you can get an experienced center forward that is in better shape than Mertens, then you probably do it, even just to give some breathers to Osimhen. You know, you give away Petagna. Petagna has been good as a third option, but he's not good enough as a second option, probably. And Mertens, as we said, he can probably give his best as a sub. So you need somebody who can give a breather to Osimhen and maybe let him learn on the pitch. So I'm not going to say Ibrahimovic, obviously, but you need probably an experienced center forward who can spell Osimhen and teach him a few things. But I do believe in Osimhen for the long run. You know, in the immediate future, probably the fact that Juventus have Ronaldo and Inter have Lukaku and Napoli don't, that's also a bit of an issue. But I think the wingbacks are a bigger issue, because the wingback situation of Napoli is just dramatic.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so let's close on this on Napoli. There's been a lot going on with the rescheduling of games. The Torino-Lazio was certainly very interesting. Napoli Outsider and I chat offline pretty often, so I've been following through. He's been keeping me up to date, and it's very, very interesting situation. So we all know how much drama came when Juve-Napoli was rescheduled, and now there's another layer of controversy because that game was rescheduled once again, which caused Roma to get really upset and some other teams as well. So I'm going to kind of leave it vague and set you up that you can kind of give us your take on how you see this whole thing, double standards, the way the media is covering it. So what is your go ahead unleash. Floor is yours.
Well, I think everything that's happened just show the state of Italian soccer, and it's not a good state. It's just been dreadful, everything, to follow it on the media, but also by the league, you know, the league standards. In the last year or so, they've done so many wrong things. It's been embarrassing. And a lot of that has just not even been discussed enough. Like, for example, this all started last year with COVID, because it's always, obviously, it's all revolving around COVID. And it all started last year. Just this January, we learned that, for example, two teams last year, instead of having regular COVID tests for their players, they actually spread them out so as to have fewer tests, obviously. You know which teams they are. I don't know if our listeners do, but the point is not so much which teams they are. It's that they, instead of being severely punished, as they should have, they only got minor fines. And so that started, I think that's where things started, because when you start giving leeways and, you know, you bend the rules or permitting things to teams, then everything just goes off. And, you know, in Italy, rules aren't always rules. They're often just suggestions. And we're masters of breaking rules or bending them for our friends. So that's where it started. And obviously those two teams were Juventus and Lazio. And I only mention it because of the irony that they were, again, touched this year by the same, by a similar situation, by the same situation in the sense it's COVID, but different stuff. So it all started with the Juventus-Napoli, obviously. That game was rescheduled, as we know, because the local sanitary authority of Naples feared there might be a breakout, a COVID breakout on the Napoli squad, because they had just played with a team that, after the game, turned out to have a breakout of its own. And Napoli had two positive COVID tests right before taking off for Turin, so they said, hey, you ain't going nowhere. So the league basically panicked, and they gave the game won to Juventus by a 3-0 scoreline. Now, they shouldn't have, because their protocol, the Serie A protocol, actually does have a force majeure case. You know, if you cannot go because a sanitary authority, a government sanitary authority, does not let you go, then the game has to be rescheduled. But they had to do that, as we mentioned back in the day, back in October now, we said this. They had to do that because Juventus and Napoli had a full schedule and there was no date for them to play. Obviously, they didn't know that both Napoli and Juventus would look atrocious in Europe, creating a whole bunch of dates. But at the time, they had no date. So they couldn't do that, and they just gave the game one to Juventus. Now, what happened recently? What happened was that Torino had a breakout, right?
Yeah.
And Torino had a breakout. Well, I should add one more thing. One of the most ferocious critics of Napoli among the media. Now, the whole media turned against Napoli. They wanted them to lose. But one of the most ferocious critics was the Gazzetta dello Sport, which is the main Italian sports newspaper.
And based
in
Milan.
They said, they're from Milan. And they are actually owned by the president of Torino because, you know, because irony is great. The irony is really great. So they were ferocious and they said, they should have taken off anyway. They should have defied authority, which obviously you cannot do. But they should have gone and so on and so on and so on. Well, obviously, once the judgment, the trial went beyond the Soccer Federation, Napoli won the trial. And it was obvious. We had predicted that. So the game was rescheduled. In the meantime, well, a couple of weeks ago, Torino had a breakout, a COVID breakout.
Yeah.
And the first game that they rescheduled was Torino Sassuolo. That was rescheduled, and nobody batted an eye. Nobody batted an eye, and that was actually kind of strange that nobody said anything. But they just let it go. And they only had 8 positive tests, which is a lot, by the way. It's a huge number.
It is.
But it's not the 10 players that they would have needed, depending on the protocol, because the protocol says that if you have at least 10 players unavailable for COVID, then you can reschedule the game, regardless of sanitary authorities. But they only had 8. That being said, the game against Sassuolo was rescheduled and nobody said anything. Then the sanitary authority said, okay, well, you couldn't play with Sassuolo, but hey, you cannot play with Lazio either, because the breakout is still going on, because in the meantime, I think they had one more positive test. So they couldn't be sure the breakout was out.
Yes.
And at that point, Lazio's president got crazy. He got upset. He said, no, they should play. They did everything that Juventus had done. So they actually announced the team that was going on the pitch and so on and so on and so on. And in the meantime, you had the Gazzetta dello Sport saying, hey, let's use common sense. Why should they play? The sanitary authority said they cannot play and so on. And it was the hypocrisy of the situation was infinite, because obviously they were the very same newspaper owned by the Torino owner that was going against Napoli back in the time. The other thing that was happening is that they were saying, okay, but the real reason the sanitary authority in Naples did not let Napoli go was that they're basically from Naples. You know, guys in the sanitary authority in Turin would not have blocked any Torino team. And they were saying that, not because of Torino, obviously, they were saying that because of Juventus. And that's something that Andrea Agnelli, the Juventus owner, actually said on TV. He said, no, the sanitary authority in Turin would have never done something like this. And guess who did it? It was, and the fact is, they didn't just stop one game, they actually stopped two games. Which was incredible. So Gazzetta dello Sport had to eat crow, and everybody basically had to eat crow. But the funny thing is that the league obviously had to reschedule the game, so they postponed it. Instead of giving the 3-0 judgment, they had to just postpone it. And so basically they validated the fact that they were bending the rules against Napoli, not because, again, it's not a conspiracy theory. I'm not saying that they wanted to penalize Napoli on purpose. I'm saying the reason they were doing it was because there was no date to reschedule at the time. And in fact, as soon as the date became available, they rescheduled it without any issue. So the issue was not penalizing Napoli. It was actually a date thing. But the problem for me wasn't so much that. That was understandable. It was the vilification, the humiliation, which actually sometimes bordered on racism, again, when they mentioned the fact that it was the Neapolitans doing that. That really pissed me off, to be honest. That was not acceptable. Because, again, I understand there was nothing personal. It was business. They did not have a makeup date. So I understand why they fought, and I understand why they lost, but they still fought for it. And I understand why right now they're not fighting for it, because obviously they have plenty of dates with Torino, Sassuolo, and Lazio going on. But the fact that they used all those bad faith arguments, that was not acceptable at the time. It reeked of hypocrisy, and it does reek of hypocrisy right now with what's happening right now. Because, again, media are just shrugging their shoulders. The only guy who's protesting is the Lazio owner. And he's probably the guy who has to shut up the most. Because not only he has done... I'm sorry to say. I mean, I usually try to be measured, but in the case of Lotito, I cannot be. Because not only of what he did last year, but because this year, allegedly, I mean, the trial was scheduled to start today, but it's going to start in 10 days because they asked for a postponement because their strategy is to run out the clock, apparently. They actually fielded, guess against who? Against Torino in their first leg of games. They fielded one or more positive players to COVID after falsifying the documents and falsifying the tests that showed they were negative. So this all came out because obviously they had a different lab that was supposed to test the players for European competitions. And you had guys who were not allowed to play in the Champions League, who all of a sudden were playing in Italy, and then they weren't allowed to play in the Champions League again. And this set off an alarm. So now obviously we are waiting for the judges to express themselves, because we have to find out if and how many players were actually positive at the time. We only have rumors, and one of the rumors revolves around Immobile, obviously. But we have to be sure. But the thing is, it almost looks 100% sure that there was at least one positive player on the pitch. So the fact that he's actually talking about protocols and sanitary authorities when he violated the protocol last year, and he did it again this year, and he did it to an extent that, according to Serie A rules, he jeopardized the health of some players, not just his players, but also the opponents, that should cause some serious penalties, not only in the league, but, I mean, they could go on and on. I'm not going to make hypotheses, but it's one of the worst things that has happened on the field in the last few years in Italy. And he is the one that's actually doing the talking right now, which is just shameful. So the thing is, Serie A botched it completely again, because they got everything wrong, basically, as much as they could, and they're just keeping getting it wrong. But the fact that the guy calling them out is the guy who's the wrongest guy, is just, I mean, it's just a never-ending loop of wrongness.
It's Italy. And in all this, in an, Go ahead, yeah.
In a nutshell, yeah, well, it's not over, though, because remember that Juventus and Napoli were scheduled to play on, tomorrow. They were supposed to play tomorrow, which was the only date, assuming that Juventus would go on all the way to the Champions League final. It was the only date, so that's why they scheduled it then.
But
as soon as Juventus got out of the Champions League, obviously, they wanted some rest. Napoli did want rest, but more it was the issue of having to play three games away from home in a row. Not only it was three games away in a row, it was three very complicated games. But they didn't have time to run the usual tests, so they actually said, hey, we got to postpone this again because we cannot have all the COVID tests, you know, before and after coming back to Naples, because we're going to have to play three games in 6 days, actually, away from home. So as soon as Juventus got out, Juventus also said, okay, we can postpone it. And the league said, okay, we'll postpone it. And at that point, Roma got really pissed off.
Yeah.
And they have some serious beef, and I think they're 100% right. Now, let me say this. I think Roma are 100% right, because the game between Juventus and Napoli at that point had been scheduled. It shouldn't have been. In my opinion, you know, if the league had been smart, just a little bit smart, they would have waited to see what Juventus did.
So
if Juventus had stayed on, they could have just scheduled it. But once you do schedule a game, you can't just postpone it because one team is tired and the other team has to experience some inconvenience. I mean, let's face it. Postponing is probably the morally right thing to do because of a series of reasons, especially in a COVID year. And especially given that there are calendar rules in Serie A that say that a team should not play three away or three home games in a row, which would have happened to Napoli. So postponing it is the right way, but the way they did it, sorry, it's the right thing to do, but the way they did it is completely wrong. They should have waited, and then as soon as Juventus made it through, they should have officialized March 17th. And if Juventus got out, they should have officialized April 7th. And in that case, nobody could have said a word. But the fact that he made it official, well, then it should have been that. It should have been just that. Again, Roma are making a fuss because they're saying, hey, we're going to get back home from Ukraine at 3 a.m. on a Friday, and we cannot postpone that game. Why is Napoli now being allowed to postpone a game that had been made official just 6 days before?
Yeah.
Because they might be tired. Because they or Juventus might be tired, or because they need to travel a lot. Well, they are right. They're 100% right. They shouldn't have been allowed, but it has been allowed. And the funny thing is how, and this again, it goes back to the fact that I don't think there was ever a conspiracy against Naples in the first place, against Napoli, by the league. Because if they had had if there had been a conspiracy, they wouldn't have allowed this to happen. But now Napoli are, again, best friends with the league because obviously they got out of the European Cups, so they don't care about you know, picking up fights. Now they can reschedule things at will because there's no point. And this makes me crazy, though, because, again, we've had a whole media thing around it, people talking about it for months. It was almost like, I don't know, something crazy had happened in the league and the corruption and so on and so on and so on when Napoli were 100% right. And now for something like this, everybody's kind of shushing it away except for Roma, who are right. And this just makes me crazy about Italy and the Italian system and things that happen around here. But it's just the way it is. And of course, in the meantime, you have a couple of trials going on that might shape the Serie A league at the end of the year. And we don't know what's going to happen. The first one is the one about Lazio. Because obviously, Lazio will probably, at the very least, if those tests were really falsified, at the very least, they will lose 3 points they gained against Torino. And they should probably get penalized more than that.
Oh, yeah.
If that's true, man, they did something that's way too dirty. They can't just lose one game. You know, they should get really hammered, if it's true. But the second thing is, who did they play against right after Torino? They played against Juventus. And they had they tied that game. So if they actually get to lose that game too, Juventus might get a +2 in their league standings. If Juventus gets a +2, they're kind of back in the Scudetto race. Right now, they are very far from Inter, sure, but they have a game in hand. and they might get 2 points over there. And all of a sudden, they would be only 5 points away from Inter. And it's bad enough if it happens now, but what if it happens in May? Because again, Lazio got a postponement on their trial, and the trial is going to have three levels of judgment. So it's probably going to go all the way probably to the end of the season. So if Juventus get way too close, let's say that Juventus finished the season 1 point or 2 points away from Inter, and it all hinges on a trial. How bad, regardless of what happens, regardless of Lazio being found at fault or innocent, what happens if the trial judgment takes place, let's say, 2 weeks from the end? And there's, and remember that there's an Inter-Juventus game being played three match days from the end. This might just cause so much chaos. And there's also another school of thought that says, hey, Lazio should get points knocked off, but Torino should not get their 3 points, and Juventus should not get the 3 points. Juventus more so because apparently, but again, this is just a rumor, Lazio only had one guy on the bench, and he was not used in the game. So apparently they had a violation, but they did not enjoy the benefits on the pitch against Juventus. But this is all rumors because the official names have not been made by the league, and the judge still has to see who was positive and who wasn't. But as you see, there's so much chaos that could shape what happens. And obviously, we're talking about the Scudetto and the Champions League race, but it's about Torino. So it's also regarding the Serie A survivor zone, the relegation zone. So all of this is going on. And then once you're done with that, probably there's going to be the trial of Luis Suarez and his documents and his paperwork. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's going to be that as well. And I don't know how that's going to go because right now it's only in civil courts. We know that there has been corruption. We just do not know who was the corruptor. We know that Juventus were involved, but we do not know if they were culprits. Now, depending on what comes out of that, because Juventus's lawyers are definitely going on trial, what we don't know if a Juventus official is going to go on trial. Now, if a Juventus official or an executive goes on trial, that is trouble for Juventus. If they don't, then that doesn't mean anything. But the thing is, even that trial is probably going to come way from now, a long time from now. So, you know, we're playing and we're, you know, as you say, shits and giggles right now. But at the end of the season, there's going to be so much chaos that it's going to be ridiculous. And this is all Serie A shaped, you know. And I think that if people call it a farmer's league, well, this year definitely has been. And it's just ridiculous what's going on. And we still don't know what's going to happen. Now, the funniest thing would be if Juventus got 2 points against Lazio at the end of the year, they caught up with Inter, and then they got some points off because of the Suarez situation. It's just ridiculous. And, you know, I do have my own ideas on the subject, but unlike the Juventus-Napoli situation, where it was crystal clear that Napoli were in the right, and that was actually shown in the trial, here things are more complicated because the documents are kind of secretive, so I will not expose my thought or how it's going to end. But I will say that I'm very curious because it could end in a variety of ways. I mean, in the worst situation, and this is if Lazio are found 100% guilty and Juventus are also found corruptors, then the two teams should be, according to soccer rules, they should be relegated. It's not going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen, by the way. I'm not clamoring it for it to happen. And I'm not saying they are culprits. I'm not saying they're guilty. I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying that in the extreme situation, even something like this could happen in theory. And this just tells you how much of a blunder Serie A has made. Because I know it's been a COVID year, but nothing has happened in any of the other leagues in terms of legal issues and so on. This stuff only happened in Serie A.
Well, it's like a soap opera. Well, this is why we're lucky to have you break all this stuff down as well as you do. So, guys, if you enjoyed Napoli Outsider on Napoli, always great. You'll always hear it for free. But I strongly recommend the segment on Serie A we are about to record. So thanks so much for doing this, my friend. And now I look forward to round two.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Dave.